Well, please be good enough as you get your seat to turn to John's Gospel, chapter 1, to page 1064. And if and when I become completely inaudible to those on the back, would someone stand on their chair and wave wildly and shout, "That's right, just get my attention." A delightful story I came across the other day about a revival preacher from the deep south of the United States who began his sermon like this. I won't attempt the accent, but he said, "Today I'm going to explain to you the unexplainable. I'm going to define the undefinable. I'm going to ponder the imponderable. I'm going to unscrew the inscrutable." Well, if God and all that surrounds him strikes you as unexplainable, then you have an ally in the John who wrote this gospel. Because at the outset he said, no one has ever seen God. None of us are in a position to explain God. We don't have the right starting points. And he went on to write that God, the one and only, he is speaking of Jesus, who is at the Father's side, has made him known. So he was signaling that he is writing a book that will reveal God to us, that will indeed explain the unexplainable. But it was a book that would reveal God for a purpose, so that we can follow him. John's Gospel here, like all the other books of the Bible, isn't a book of pure theory. It's a book written for a practical purpose, that we should know how to follow God. It's a book written for discipleship. And so the question that it'll always be asking us is this: have we acted on what has been revealed here? Have we done what we're meant to do with what we discover? Bernard Levin, as many of you know, writes a regular column in the Times newspaper. And he wrote this about Christ and what he discovered about Christ. "Is not the nature of Christ, in the words of the New Testament, enough to pierce to the soul anyone with a soul to be pierced? He still looms over the world, his message still clear, his pity still infinite, his consolation still effective, his words still full of glory, wisdom, and love." To Bernard Levin and many, many others, Jesus is a figure of immense attraction. But Levin is emphatic that he, Bernard Levin, is not a Christian. He wrote recently, "For the 14,000th time, I am not a Christian." Well, I think the message is clear. And what I'm trying to say tonight is that John, in his gospel, will still be writing with a purpose. He won't be satisfied with those who admire the Christ of his gospel. He is looking for discipleship, and "come and see" is his cry, and it's his cry to the Bernard Levins of this world, as well as to many, many others. And just before John launches into his story of Jesus fully, he gives us a preview. A glimpse, a snatch of insight into someone who is coming to follow Jesus, to faith in Jesus and to trust him. And that's the story we're looking at tonight. It's a story that focuses on Nathanael, but it begins with his friend Philip. And he's a key person. So look at Philip, the first person we'll notice tonight, the first character, a friend with a discovery. A friend with a discovery. It's a little theme at the end of this opening chapter. As the early disciples gather around Jesus, time and again they're brought by a friend. John the Baptist tells two about Jesus. One of them is Andrew. Andrew comes to Jesus and immediately goes and finds his brother Simon. Philip, we're told, found Nathanael and told him. John has a remarkable history to tell of Jesus, and it's a history that has been kept alive until the moment John writes his gospel. and has spread and goes on spreading and spreading right down to the present day by very ordinary means. Friends with a discovery. Look how the story begins in verse 44. Philip, like Andrew and Peter, was from the town of Bethsaida. Philip found Nathanael and told him. We discover later that Nathanael was sitting under a fig tree. It seems that in many Jewish villages and market towns of the day, the fig tree was the place where you stopped and you would often meditate and think through perhaps the scriptures. So it may have been that Philip sat down next to Nathanael and they got talking and discussing. Well, whatever happened, sooner or later, Philip blurted out what he'd discovered. And you can't miss the sense of excitement, can you? Philip found Nathanael and told him, "We have found the one." Now, there's no credit attached to it, because, of course, the whole incident had begun with Jesus finding Philip. He found me, I found him. A Christian will say both about their relationship to Christ. "We found the one," says Philip, "the one that Moses wrote about in the law and about whom the prophets also wrote." Now, Nathanael was a Jew, and his expectations were shaped by his scriptures, our Old Testament. Moses was a colossus of those scriptures, and he promised that one day God would raise up a prophet, a teacher, a revealer of God of immense stature. Later prophets sketched out other figures who would come, a king who would free God's people, an anointed one, a Messiah, a Christ, whom God would send. Well, says Philip, "We've found the one." For thousands of years, God had been revealing himself and promising he would come. And Philip gets hold of Nathanael and he says, "He has come. And we've found him." Now, I imagine that we're not crowded out with people from a Jewish background steeped in the Jewish Old Testament scriptures tonight. There'll be many of us who, because of our backgrounds, have far less defined expectations of how God might ever break into our world. And yet those longings for something or someone are still very profound, aren't they? At the risk of giving him a monopoly, let me quote Bernard Levin one last time. "Countries like ours," he wrote, "are full of people who have all the material comforts they desire, together with such non-material blessings as a happy family, and yet lead lives of quiet, and at times noisy, desperation, understanding nothing but that there is a hole inside them, and that however much food and drink they pour into it, however many motor cars and television sets they stuff it with, however many well-balanced children and loyal friends they parade around the edges of it, it aches. It aches." And to people like that, the Philips of this world, the John who writes his gospel wants to say, "We have found the one designed to satisfy that aching hole. Come and see." We heard something earlier this evening of Jane's story. A couple of weeks ago in our first service back here, we had a baptism. And I had Sarah up with me, whom we were about to baptize, and I asked her to tell us something of her story. And she told of how she'd come from a very moral family with a deep sense of morality, but nothing more. And she had in recent years come to work in the city in one of the big merchant banks, and she found that two of her colleagues in the office used to disappear regularly at Tuesday lunchtime. One day she stopped them and she said, "Where do you go to every Tuesday lunchtime?" And to her astonishment, they told her, "Church." She told me earlier she was convinced they went off to the pub. But no church, they said. Well, can I come too, she asked. So they brought her along to the Tuesday lunchtime services we have for business people, and she said that that is where she found the missing piece. She got most of the morality in shape, but that's where she discovered the God who made sense of it all. As we were on the way out at the end of the service, someone just stopped me and said, you know, I found that a very helpful interview. I said, why? Well, they said, I've always assumed that no one really wants to know about Jesus. And what Sarah reminded me is that there are some people who might just be ready and all they need is to be told, come along. All they need is some friend who's made the discovery to come and say, we've found the one, come and see. Well, Philip certainly tried it on Nathaniel. And as Philip speaks to Nathaniel, and certainly as John speaks to us, he's not just speaking into our own felt needs. He also speaks of all those rumors of a God at work, of the purposes of history, of origins and destiny, of questions like, who am I and why am I here? And John is saying, we found the one who explains what God is really doing. Come and see. If this story teaches nothing else, it's a reminder of the immense value of a friend with a discovery. Second character to meet in the story. This is Nathaniel, a skeptic, a doubter with integrity. A skeptic with integrity. We've found the one, Philip says in verse 45, the one Moses wrote about in the law and about whom the prophets also wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph. And you can almost hear the groan, can't you, between verse 45 and verse 46. Nazareth. Oh, can anything good come from there? What a letdown. Now remember, Nathanael is a Galilean himself, but it appears that even Galileans despise Nazareth. It wasn't just, though, uninformed prejudice. Messiah's birth had been predicted in the scriptures, but he wasn't going to be born in Nazareth. No, Bethlehem was the place. A King David's city. The city with royal overtones. Now, Jesus had been born in Bethlehem, of course, but he'd left there very fast. And he'd been brought up in Nazareth. And so he was called as coming from that town, Jesus of Nazareth. As a matter of fact, it's a remarkable example of his humility that he was willing to be known as Jesus of Nazareth. I spent 9 years in Norfolk. And anyone who's been in Norfolk will know that when you come to Norwich, which is where all roads seem to lead in Norfolk, no matter what direction you reach Norwich from, you'll come across a sign that says, Welcome to Norwich, a fine city. Well, that's how it likes to think of itself. If they had those signs up in those days, you might have Welcome to Bethlehem, a royal city. And if they'd ever dared put one up, it must have read something like this, Welcome to Nazareth, the pits. Well, Jesus was willing to be known as Jesus of Nazareth. Nazareth, can anything good come from there, Nathanael asked. Well, where do you go from there, Philip? It all sounded so great, didn't it, until Nathanael opened his mouth. Come and see, said Philip. It's all he can say. Examine the evidence, Nathanael. Come and look for yourself. And I think one of the reasons John records it is because it is as if, as he writes his gospel, he anticipates readers groaning. As excitedly he announces, we've found the one. And when they hear who it is, they say, oh, not Jesus. Can't we try something new? Can anything good come from church? The Bible? And John wants to say what Philip said. Come and see. Come and read my book. Come and look at the evidence for yourself. I heard the other day of a missionary who'd been working in the Middle East with children. And one day she just tried to drive into the local town. And just before she got there, her Jeep ran out of petrol in the desert road. She realized what it was. She turned it all off. She didn't have any jerry cans with her. She searched the vehicle top to bottom looking for a container. And all she could find was a potty. So reluctantly she picked it up and she trudged the mile from where she'd broken down to where the nearest petrol station was. She filled up her potty with petrol and very carefully she walked back along the road with it. And when she got to the Jeep, she sort of unscrewed the petrol tank and she was slowly trying to pour it as carefully as she could into the tank. As she was doing it, one of these great sort of limousines swept along the road with a few rather sort of oil-rich shakes or whatever inside it, and it stopped alongside her. One of them wound down the window and watched fascinated as she poured the contents of this potty into the petrol tank. And he leaned out and he said to her, excuse me, he said, my friend and I, although we don't share your religion, we greatly admire your faith. Well, people speak sometimes, don't they, of Christianity or of becoming a Christian as taking some step of blind faith about the same as expecting a car to run on the normal contents of a potty. Well, it involves faith, trust, dependence on Jesus, but not blind faith. No, faith that is a response to the evidence and where it leads. Faith that has come and seen and acted. And Nathanael is hardly the picture of a man showing blind faith. He is a skeptic. He is cynical that they could possibly have found the one from Nazareth. And you notice he's not condemned for that. Questions are a perfectly valid starting place. When Jane came into that Discovering Christianity group, well, it would have been a group where questions were encouraged to be brought out and put on the table. Come and see. Now, the mark of Nathanael is not that he isn't a skeptic. He's a skeptic, all right, but he's a skeptic with integrity. Come and see, said Philip. So, verse 47, what does Nathanael do? Well, he comes and sees. When Jesus saw Nathanael approaching, he said of him, here is a true Israelite in whom there is nothing false. That's what marks Nathanael out. Although he can't believe there could be anything good from Nazareth, he'll go and test the evidence. He's a skeptic with integrity. The name Israel, Israelite, comes from the name given to the founding father of the people, Jacob. He was the Old Testament patriarch who was eventually called Israel by God. Now, Jacob means the deceiver. It summed up his nature. He was a cunning twister, a con artist who knew how to put one over his brother Esau. But Nathanael, Jesus is saying, is not like that at all. He is an Israelite with no guile, with no deceit in him. He's prepared to go where the evidence takes him, and it's the kind of sincerity that is rewarded by discovery. Here's a true Israelite in whom there is nothing false, says Jesus. How do you know me? Nathanael asked. And Jesus answered, I saw you while you were still under the fig tree before Philip called you. Well, whatever it said to Nathanael, it was convincing to him, for he immediately declares, verse 49, Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel. Now, both those phrases may mean nothing more to Nathanael than that Jesus was God's chosen king to rescue his people, the Jews. But John includes them because by the end of his book, they'll come to mean something far wider still. Our skeptic with integrity, John begins and ends his book with skeptics, with doubters. Nathanael at this end, Thomas at the far end. They're both men of integrity. Come and see, Nathanael is told, and he comes. Put your finger here, Thomas is told. See my hands, reach out your hand and put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe. Both men who, far from leaping in the dark, believe on the basis of the evidence. You are the Son of God, says Nathanael. My Lord and my God. Thomas's great statement of faith rounds off the gospel. Well, I picked up on the way in a copy of one of those Discovering Christianity leaflets. I seem to have lost it again now, but I thought I ought to check what Roy puts in all these leaflets without just letting them go by. And one of the questions I noticed he shoved down was this: who is it for? And the answer he'd written was, anyone not yet convinced, but prepared to look at the evidence. Well, that was Nathanael. That's the challenge to any skeptic. Discovering Christianity is for a skeptic with integrity. A friend with a discovery. A skeptic with integrity. Lastly, just notice this one other character. Well, it's the same character changed. It's Nathanael at the end of the story. A believer with a future. A believer with a future. Let me explain what I mean. For so many people, belief is such a static thing. You either have it or you don't. Now, there's a way in which that's true, but there's also an attitude that too easily locks Christians into the past. The Christian life is described in terms of one event that took them from no faith to faith. As if, done that? Oh, great. Well, that's it. It's all over. It's finished now. You've done all that needs doing. When I first started to trust in Jesus, I was just a student at college. I had a Christian friend. He was a year or two ahead of me. He was a very wise Christian friend, and he once said this to me. He said, "Hugh, I dread it when I hear that someone's friend has been converted." I was horrified. I said, "What are you talking about, Mark? I thought you wanted them converted." Oh, he said, "Yes, I do want them converted." He said, "But I dread it when I hear they're converted because I keep on fearing that the friend will stop praying." As if now they're converted, that's all there is to be done. I want you to see that faith here is something far more dynamic. Look at verse 50. Jesus said, "You believe because I told you I saw you under the fig tree." Yeah, you have got faith, but you shall see greater things than that. The picture is much more like this, isn't it? That faith has launched Nathanael onto a voyage, a journey of discovery. You believe, but he hasn't got it all buttoned up. There's growing, there's expanding still to be done. What was it? I think I remember rightly from school. In 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. I think that's right, isn't it? I was told it was right in the first service, but you never know whether the people in the congregation have got it right. He was meant to have founded the America there, wasn't he? And 1992 was meant to be the 500th anniversary. The only problem was we realized others had got there first, and he probably never made it to the mainland anyway, only to the West Indies, so it was a bit of a damp squib. But imagine he had made it all the way to the mainland and he put the flag down on the shore and he said, "I found America." What would he actually have found? One beach.
That's actually what would have happened, isn't it? First person who lands, that's all they've discovered, a beach. They don't know there's a whole continent to discover behind it. I've found, and I've plenty to discover. That's true for the explorer. And that's really what every Christian wants to say. I've found the one. And I have a whole continent, a whole new world to discover and explore. You see, so many of us get converted on a very, very narrow front, don't we? One felt need is met. One shaft of light and of truth is seen. God very graciously has us like that. There's nothing wrong with starting like that. It's just dreadful if we finish there. Nathanael's finding has brought him in touch with a whole new world to find, and it's a world that focuses on Jesus. He can say now, Rabbi, you are the Son of God, you are the King of Israel. But Jesus said, you'll see greater things than that. And he then added, verse 51, I tell you the truth, you shall see heaven open and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man. May not mean a lot to us. Would have meant a lot to Nathanael. Remember, he was a Jew. It would have conjured up for him immediately a picture from his scriptures, the story of Jacob. When he'd left home with his tail between his legs, so to speak, and he'd crashed out one night, he'd laid down and slept, and he had a dream. And in that dream, he saw this ladder going from earth to heaven, and the angels going up and down it. And it was a picture to him of God's blessing on him, of how God's purposes would be worked out through Jacob. Well, Jesus says to Nathanael, I tell you the truth, Nathanael. Truly, truly, you shall see heaven open. And the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man, on Jesus. You'll see heaven opened and you'll see God's purposes for the world worked out in Jesus. For Jesus is where these two worlds will meet. The Son of Man is the only one who's been to heaven, who knows what it's like, who can reveal it. And he says to Nathanael, as you watch me, you'll see the world of heaven being opened and made known to this world here on earth. Now, if there was no more finding to be done, to be quite honest, we'd just run Discovering Christianity and leave it there. Nothing else to do. And if the finding didn't focus on Jesus, well, we certainly wouldn't run Read, Mark, Learn, studying Mark's Gospel, which focuses on Jesus. But Nathanael's story is a reminder that if we're a believer, there's still plenty of finding to be done. The Nathanael story is a reminder of one other thing too. Just keep a finger in John chapter 1. Will you turn right back? We might as well look at the scriptures that Nathanael would have been reminded of. It's back on page 30, right at the very beginning of the Bibles. It may not be our culture and background, but God is very gracious, and he speaks into the culture and background of the people he's speaking to. Nathanael would have known this story because it's God's story. Genesis chapter 28 and verse 12. Jacob had a dream in which he saw a stairway resting on the earth with its top reaching to heaven, and the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And there above it stood the Lord, and he said, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. I will give you and your descendants the land on which you are lying. Your descendants will be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west and to the east, to the north and to the south. All peoples on earth will be blessed through you and your offspring. Jacob is homeless. Jacob is single. And
God gives this remarkable promise and blessing to him, that his promises for the whole world will be worked out through Jacob. Jacob is going to be the father of a great nation. Well, as we come back to our story in John's Gospel, Jesus says, I tell you the truth, Nathanael, you'll see heaven opened, you'll see that worked out, not on Jacob, but in me. Jacob was the father of a great nation. Jesus is going to be the founder of a new nation, a new people. The one who reveals heaven to earth is the one who will rescue and redeem a people of earth for heaven. And becoming a Christian isn't just about being able to say a creed. No, it's joining a new community. It's joining a new people. It's joining a new family. You notice what Jane said about her Read, Mark, Learn group. It wasn't just a place where she could learn new truths, but meet new people, meet new Christians, become part of the family that she'd actually joined. Well, Nathanael will discover something of the scope of that Christian family, and I suspect that his eyes would have popped out of his head when he started to make that discovery. We had a brilliant international tea earlier on this afternoon. Roy totted them up, and he managed to count 19 nations represented there. It included England, it included Wales, Elspeth. They crept in somehow or other. But God's new people will have infinitely more nations represented than that. You see, Nathanael comes and he starts to believe, but I suspect, like almost all of us, he comes with muddled perceptions. It's very rare to have our slate clean when we come to God. You're the Son of God, he's able to say. You're the King of Israel. But those are phrases with all manner of overtones and undercurrents that link them in nationalistically to the Jewish nation. Jesus spoke of himself as the Son of Man. It's a figure from Nathanael's scriptures, but it doesn't carry any of those overtones. It's a figure who will appear at the end of history to exercise universal rule and receive the worship of the nations. And Jesus says, that's me. The ruler and Lord of God's people, the new founding father as Jacob had been. And Jesus says, that's me. But that's all part of the future for Nathanael. A friend with a discovery came to him and found in Nathanael a skeptic with integrity. And he becomes, at the end of the story, a believer with a future. Well, what we're wanting to say tonight is welcome. Welcome to a voyage of discovery. It's a journey that many tonight will have started on. It's a journey that all of us need to begin at some stage to reach the launching pad. Jesus said later on in John's Gospel, when you've lifted up the Son of Man, then you'll know that I'm the one I claim to be. When you've lifted him up as he was when he died on a cross, strung up above the crowds, bearing our sin. When you've lifted him up as he was when he was raised to heaven, then you'll know that I'm the one I claim to be. We look back on those events, don't we, with hindsight. Many of us can look back with a certain amount of knowledge and understanding. And yet we may still need John's question asking of us, what have I done with what's been revealed to me? It was either yesterday or the day before, I was hearing the story of the start of this journey for one Christian leader. He'd been in a small group and they'd been studying the cross of Jesus, and he understood how Jesus had died for his sins. He could understand all of that. His problem was that he didn't think he was a sinner. He was a good guy.
And one evening as they met together, his wife said, I think it's time to do something about all we've been learning. And right in front of the group, she got on her knees and she started praying. Oh God, she said, I'm sorry for my sin. Husband thought she'd flipped, praying to the ceiling. Looked around at the other six or seven friends and realized they'd got their eyes closed. And to his horror, he began to grasp. He thought, they've all prayed this prayer too. It frightened him. And then he began to realize she wasn't praying to the ceiling. She was praying to a God who could hear her, a living God who would forgive her. And in comparison to him, she knew she was not good. Shook him to the core. Although he knew he was a good guy, he was absolutely sure she was better. And as the truth began to dawn on him, he himself got to his knees and started praying to God for forgiveness. And as he did it in that way that's true probably for many of us, that he prayed with utmost sincerity, and he was also thinking to himself, I hope this thing works because I'm making a complete fool of myself if not. 20-30 years on, however many years it is now, he looks back and he says, that was the night I came to the cross and started out with Christ. Might be a great night tonight for someone to start out with Christ. To start off on this road to discovery. Now, we talked about ways in which many can do it, some of these groups to sign up for. But if you feel you've never even reached square one, and tonight would be a great night to do it. Well, I've got some booklets. Well, I was going to say I've got some booklets. I had a stack of them around at the end of the first service. Roy, yeah, you'll have some booklets, won't you? I've got a John's Gospel. If you want to read it, that's a great place to find. I've got one or two little booklets with titles like Journey into Life, How to Actually Begin. So while others are muddling around at the end and talking and being friendly and polite and nice and visiting welcome desks or leather jackets, come and grab a booklet from me or from Roy. Do ask us. But whatever we do, let's start on this journey of discovery. Be great to be like Philip, a friend with a discovery, able to say, I've found. And if we've found, to be those who are determined to go on finding and see those greater things. Let's pray together. Our gracious God, we ask that in your mercy, you might find each and every one of us in this building tonight and humble us and set us on the road to finding more. For Jesus' sake, Amen.